What happens when you're living the dream everyone told you to chase, but you can barely afford groceries? At 25, working as a literary assistant in Manhattan while living in Brooklyn, the gap between cultural capital and actual capital became impossible to ignore. Publishing felt like an industry perpetually on life support, squeezed by consolidation and the relentless dominance of one online superstore. Meanwhile, an ebook startup had just raised $3 million, and its three clean-cut founders radiated a confidence that felt alien to publishing's anxious halls. The assistant class whispered about whether there'd even be room for us as the industry contracted. Living on $30,000 in New York meant choosing between networking drinks and groceries, between the right wardrobe and rent. The older generation treated poverty wages as character building, a necessary hazing ritual, while ordering salmon and rose at lunch. Borrowing money from parents to make rent felt like failure, even with the safety net of a debt-free education and 1 year left on their health insurance. When that ebook startup offered $20 an hour for nebulous work, some curation, some copywriting, some secretarial tasks, it felt like being valued for the first time. The founders actually asked for opinions and listened. That attention was intoxicating. After the ebook startup failed, the founders landed an interview at a hot analytics company, a four-year-old startup founded by college dropouts with $12 million in funding. Despite zero technical qualifications, the offer arrived. Customer support role with medical coverage, $4,000 relocation, and a $65,000 salary described as above market and non-negotiable. Returning to San Francisco with a fresh haircut and two fraying duffel bags felt pioneering, though thousands had already rushed west chasing this new American dream. Tech companies imported computer science graduates with six-figure signing bonuses, while non-technical people followed, hoping some of that gold dust would settle on them too. The analytics startup sold pickaxes during the gold rush, infrastructure for the big data era. They helped companies track user behavior without complex coding, offering colorful dashboards that made data feel like revelation. The pricing was brilliantly simple, free until a threshold, then metered by data volume. As customers grew, so did revenue, a perfect alignment venture capitalists loved. The solutions team received God mode, omniscient access to every customer's data. This privileged view shattered startup mythology. Supposed rocket ships sputtering on fumes, gaming apps spiking brilliantly before flaming out, all cushioned by venture capital despite clear trajectories toward obsolescence. We operated on good faith, assuming curiosity wouldn't lead us to track celebrities or exploit insights for stock trading. No policies existed against leaks or insider trading. We were all down for the cause. Work became identity. The culture was seductive. Flannel shirts, work boots, vitamin supplements, and an unexpected affinity for EDM music that made mundane tasks feel significant. The pulsing beats created a sensation of momentum and power. Every Tuesday at noon, San Francisco's emergency sirens coincided with the all-hands meeting, where employees gathered around the CEO like children at a progressive kindergarten, sharing detailed metrics that created the illusion of transparency and collective impact. San Francisco strained under the invasion, a historically bohemian haven for hippies, queers, artists, and activists, now infiltrated by capital and bland masculinity. Newcomers wore $700 Patagonia jackets to climate-controlled offices with cold brew on tap, pursuing curated authenticity without recognizing they had become the city's most authentic feature. Private shuttles, gleaming white buses with tinted windows, ferried workers through neighborhoods like daily reminders of growing divides. Tech companies built suburban campuses with gourmet cafeterias and yoga studios, eliminating any need to leave. Stark inequality manifested everywhere. Homeless encampments beneath luxury high-rises where one bedroom's rented for $4,000 monthly. A tiny 400-square-foot studio with barred windows but undeniable character, bay window, shared garden, view of a gnarled tea tree, cost $1,800 monthly, consuming 40% of take-home pay. The neighborhood revealed its true nature after sunset: homelessness, drug activity, and tourists seeking remnants of 60s counterculture. Solitary weekends brought both liberating freedom and crushing loneliness. Hours in Golden Gate Park's hidden meadows, solo bike rides, dining alone with a phone as companion. In Silicon Valley's pecking order, non-engineers constantly proved their worth. Soft skills were systematically undervalued, despite emotional intelligence being nearly impossible to teach, unlike coding. The operations manager, a former public defender who quietly ran the entire company from HR to board meetings, received less recognition than anyone who could write a Rails app. Working as the only woman on a team supporting male software developers became an exercise in internalized misogyny. Constantly deferring to male egos, affirming them, advocating for their advancement. One particularly jarring incident involved a middle-aged influencer approaching to say he loved dating Jewish women because we're so sensual. When reported, the manager merely shrugged it off. As the annual review approached, the debate intensified. Mention the casual sexism permeating the workplace? Colleagues with animated breast GIFs on smartwatches, comments about appearance, an influencer's bangable women ranking list. When emailing a mother about these issues expecting support, the immediate warning came, don't put complaints about sexism in writing unless you have a lawyer ready. Even family understood that speaking truth to power in tech came with professional suicide risk. When news broke about an NSA contractor leaking classified surveillance information, coworkers barely reacted. The revelation that the NSA was tracking citizens using cookies, the same technology central to our analytics software, went undiscussed. Most disturbing was that lower-level NSA employees could access databases to spy on loved ones. Yet these parallels to our own work remained unexamined, comforted by the belief that we were the good guys. A fired former colleague looked happier, considering opening a worker-owned bagel shop while consciously avoiding tech terminology. More disturbingly, he called our former employer a surveillance company, drawing parallels between ad tech and government surveillance. We were one subpoena away from collaborating with intelligence agencies. His perspective troubled deeply. Despite all the industry talk about changing the world, the moral implications of data collection had never been seriously considered. When the company released a feature called Addiction, graphing how frequently users engaged with apps, the unease was profound. Ghostwriting promotional pieces celebrating how companies could measure their embeddedness in users' lives felt deeply wrong. Behind noble-sounding missions of helping people make better decisions lay cynical goals, increasing engagement, reducing friction, enabling digital dependency. The end game was always growth at any cost, scale above all, disrupt, then dominate. Yet the inefficient life with its human messiness felt infinitely preferable to the frictionless world being built. Joining an open-source startup felt like redemption. Fair pay, trustworthy management, accountability. The company had revolutionized collaborative programming with a beloved platform, founded by four programmers with techno-utopian ideals. The terms of service team handled moderation challenges, copyright claims, harassment, threats, pornography, malware, illegal content, reluctant content moderators for 9 million users. Drawing consistent lines between free speech and abuse proved impossible. When trolls created a repository targeting women and gaming with personal information, weeks of debate preceded disabling it, triggering death threats. Coworkers dismissed the danger as just assholes or bored students. As the 2016 election approached, encountering early Pizzagate content led to disengagement. The realization came later. Perhaps the significance was missed from becoming more of a product of the tech industry, with its context aversion and emphasis on speed and scale, than desired. After the election, someone whispered, "There are no adults in the White House. We're the government now." Leaving in early 2018 felt anticlimactic. When news broke of a $7.5 billion acquisition, modest shares were suddenly worth about $200,000 before taxes. The feeling wasn't pride, only relief and guilt. Many women in non-technical roles couldn't afford to exercise options, missing the bonanza. There had been a long-held belief that entrepreneurs harbored deeper spiritual yearnings beneath startup fanaticism, partly an attempt to alleviate guilt about participating in a globally extractive project, but mostly projection. Eventually came mourning for these conceits, the realization that a system should have been seen rather than stories sought. The young men of Silicon Valley had power, wealth, and control, and were ecstatic about the future. The person with the yearning was always oneself.